This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sherry Kolb, professor of law and Charles Evans Hughes Scholar at Cornell University Law School, where she teaches courses in animal rights, evidence, and criminal procedure. She is a graduate of Columbia College and Harvard Law School, and a former law clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blackmun. Sherry Kolb is here today to tell us about her book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger? And Other Questions People Ask Vegans, published in 2013. Welcome, Sherry.
Thank you.
What led you to write your book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger? What is your goal?
Well, when I became vegan, people asked me a lot of the questions that come up in the book, and there's nothing out there for me to read other than sort of FYIs that would list a few quick answers. And I wondered about a lot of the questions myself, so I decided to start investigating them, and also writing the book allowed me to delve into the questions so that I could be informed and also come to my own conclusions about some of these issues, which are not easy issues.
What is your definition of vegan?
Well, I think that you sort of want to distinguish between vegan products and vegan people. So a vegan product would be something that does not contain any animal ingredients. And people who are vegan are people who opt out of using animals for food or clothing, etc. So it's sort of people who boycott cruelty to animals through their consumption decisions.
How common are vegans in the U.S.?
There are different estimates of how many vegans there are. At the low end, around 3 million in the United States. At the higher end, between 6 and 8 million. So I think it's a growing group of people, but I don't know precisely how many.
What led you personally to become vegan?
Well, I have always cared a lot about animals. For me, it was dogs and cats. Growing up, I really loved dogs and cats and thought of myself as somebody who cared a lot about animals. And then meeting farmed animals and realizing that they're just as affectionate and playful and conscious as the animals that I knew, you know, to be that way. And learning about veganism then allowed me sort of to link my own behavior out there in the marketplace with my values and caring about animals. And as it turned out, there's terrific food, and it's really been very easy to opt out of participating in herding animals.
What do you see as the key reasons for becoming vegan overall? Would you give an overview?
I think that maybe there are three sort of reasons that leap out. But the primary reason for me has been animals, that all uses of animals involve tremendous suffering and an early death. And to be vegan means no longer to be funding that, no longer to be participating in that. So that's a really crucial reason for me. Another reason for veganism is the environment. Animal agriculture is really an ecological disaster, and we've gotten reports from the UN and the World Bank indicating just what a tremendous toll animal agriculture takes in terms of not just global warming. It also pollutes the water, uses up fresh water, it pollutes the air, and it yields food shortages because of the inefficiency of growing crops in order to feed to animals that you then use for food. And finally, health. The evidence increasingly links animal foods to chronic disease like diabetes and cardiovascular disease and a number of cancers. So that's another reason that people begin to consume vegan foods rather than animal-based food.
In your book, you state that most of us are in a state of ethical slumber in regard to our treatment of animals. Would you explain?
Yes. I think that most people's self-image is that, you know, I'm empathic to animals. Many of us have animal companions in our homes. We get very angry when we hear about somebody abusing an animal like Michael Vick or other animal abusers. But at the same time, we fail to connect meat and poultry and fish and dairy and eggs to cruelty towards animals. So in that sense, we're sort of morally asleep when it comes to the role that we're playing in herding animals, even as we're sort of turning and thinking other people are guilty and we want them punished or whatever, and that sometimes we don't fully realize that we're funding as much and more cruelty to animals as the people that we point a finger at.
Why do you think people are in this state of ethical slumber in regard to treatment of animals?
I think it's sort of cultural habit. George Bernard Shaw once said that custom will reconcile people to any atrocity. And I think that using animals in our culture is very routine for people. You know, people eat three meals and often snacks, all of which will contain animal ingredients, wear wool and down and leather, and just do this sort of without thinking about it. And so when we have children, our children, through repetition and through being trained not to care, become numb to or ethically asleep about this. And a lot of kids actually have a moment where they say, wait a minute, when I'm eating this chicken, that's a chicken, you know, and they're sort of shocked, and then they're told things that really aren't accurate, like, well, animals really have good lives, and we need to eat them in order to be healthy, and none of that is true, and they don't have good lives. But after a while, our habits kind of drive our thinking, and our moral sense is no longer engaged by things that it really needs to be.
Why not just be vegetarian? What is the harm in eggs, cheese, and milk?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of people have the impulse that if you consult your imagination, slaughterhouse role is much more obvious when people are talking about eating the flesh of a dead animal, and then they can see it pretty clearly. But with products from live animals, it's easy to imagine that that could be peaceful. You sort of imagine a farm and the cows are being milked and it's very nice, and there are chickens in a little barn and laying an egg. But our imagination turns out to be really uninformed. And for these products like dairy and eggs, which are what ovo-lacto-vegetarians consume, essentially you're consuming a female reproductive product. And when we have that, we exploit the females. We typically kill the males because they're not useful. And then we ultimately kill the females when they're quite young and they're no longer useful. So for dairy, in order for a cow to be able to give milk, many people don't know this, but they have to be pregnant, just like all mammals, just like humans. We don't just give milk, but we become pregnant, and then we have a baby, and then we make milk, and we lactate for our baby. And so that involves impregnating the females, and almost all the cows are impregnated through forced insemination, which people within the industry sometimes refer to as a rape rack. Then when the babies are born, they're taken away so we can, you know, utilize the milk for making products for people. And if the baby is male, typically they're killed as veal or as cheap beef. And if they're female, they might become veal, or they might also be impregnated and enter the cycle, which is a horrible thing for a cow because they love their babies. All mammals really form a very strong attachment to their babies, and the dairy industry really violates that attachment, and there's a great deal of pain and distress associated with that for both the mother and the baby. And then ultimately, when the cow gives out from all of the constant pregnancy and lactation, about 4 or 5 years into her life, she's also sent to slaughter instead of living 20 years, which is how long a dairy cow from that breed would normally live. All of the eggs pretty much come from a hatchery where the egg-laying hens are separated into male and female, and all of the males are killed immediately, usually by being thrown into a meat grinder alive or by being thrown into a bag and suffocated. And that's just a routine part of what it means to provide eggs. And the females then lay about 300 eggs a year. No matter what kind of farm they're on, they've been genetically bred for that. And to compare that to their wild relative, the red jungle fowl, who lays about 20 eggs a year. So their calcium is depleted after a short time, and they're considered spent after 2 years. They've sort of been completely destroyed by this process, and so they're usually either sent to slaughter when they're 2 years old, or sometimes just thrown out because they're no longer useful, and it may cost more to send them to slaughter than it's even worth. So essentially, dairy cows and egg-laying hens all get slaughtered. The cows suffer the loss of their babies, and their bodies have been bred to make a lot of milk and eggs, so they're very early in their life depleted. And that's inherent in those industries, and that's why being vegetarian just leaves all of that in place and continues to fund it.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell University Law School and author of the book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger and Other Questions People Ask Vegans. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How much of the harm in dairy and egg production is due to factory farming? Do family and organic farms solve the problem?
That's a really good question. Factory farms have definitely intensified suffering and harm. And, of course, most of the products that people consume, even if they're labeled in other ways, are from factory farms. But the suffering and harm was great even before the advent of factory farms, and organic and family farms don't solve the problem. For the dairy cows, for example, they have the same short life, 4 to 5 years. The males are killed, the dairy cows' babies. Their babies are all taken away, and the females are slaughtered. So that all remains true. It's just that their daily life isn't quite as horrible, and they still undergo a lot of very painful interventions. And then eggs, you know, all of these eggs come from the same hatcheries that kill all the males. So the really fundamental difficulties with these industries aren't addressed simply by having it come from an organic or family farm.
What about plants? Plants are also living entities, so why is it more ethical to eat plants than animals?
Well, so far as we know, it's true that plants are alive, but we don't, so far as we know, have reason to think that plants are sentient, which means conscious, able to suffer, able to feel pleasure, able to care about their own lives. And animals are sentient, so that gives rise to ethical obligations to those who have preferences, who have interests, and that's what distinguishes plants and animals.
There are some who argue that plants may be sentient, so what if plants are sentient?
Well, that's a good question. If plants are sentient, if it turned out that we discovered that plants were sentient, it would still be ethically preferable to consume plants because it kills a lot more plants to feed plants to an animal and then feed the animal to a human, just in terms of efficiency. So even if you're trying to reduce as much as possible the number of plants you kill, you can do that best by eating the plants directly and eliminate the middle cow, I guess would be a way of putting it, you dramatically reduce the sentient beings harmed, even if they were to include plants.
Another question asked of vegans is, don't animals eat other animals? What is your response?
My response is that some animals do eat other animals and some do not. A lot of the animals that we consume are actually herbivores. So to the extent that we think that, well, the animals deserve it because they eat other animals, well, you know, the cows don't. So they don't deserve it. But beyond that, it's also true that we fundamentally have a choice. We don't have to eat animals or animal products. And carnivores, like the obligate carnivores like killer whales and lions, don't really have a choice, first of all, because of their biology. Their biology is sort of uniquely built to need and to want animal products and, you know, to hunt and so on. And our biology actually much more closely resembles that of herbivores. And in addition, and perhaps most importantly, we have a moral choice. When my dog tries to pursue an animal outside, I can't explain to my dog that, you know, actually we eat a vegan diet and the dog does as well, and so I don't think that's right. I can't explain that to him because he's very driven and doesn't have the moral choice. But I have a moral choice, so I don't need to emulate carnivores and omnivores in nature because I have a choice both in terms of my moral agency and in terms of what I can eat that'll make me healthy and thrive. And therefore, I don't need to emulate the carnivorous animals. I can emulate the herbivorous ones.
To what extent do humanely raised, that's quote-unquote animal products, address the concerns for animals?
I think they really don't. I think they indicate that people want to do better by animals. So I think the fact that there are these products is a sign that people want to do better, but I don't think that consuming these products actually accomplishes anything really positive. The use of the word, for example, humane, is peculiar because humane really means to show compassion or mercy, and slaughtering an animal when it's not necessary to do that is not humane. And beyond slaughter, which, you know, all of these animals are slaughtered, much of what happens on, quote, humane farms would really strike us as torture if it were done to a companion animal, like castration without anesthesia, branding without anesthesia, lots of mutilations, separation from babies at birth. So I think that we're kind of changing the definition of humane when we talk about humanely raised animal products, and it functions more as a kind of a word to soothe us in our sort of moral obliviousness rather than a factually accurate description of what's happening.
What is your long-term goal for domesticated animals? How do you see the future unfolding if everyone becomes a vegan?
Well, that would be fantastic if everyone became vegan. And my long-term goal would be that we stop breeding domesticated animals, that we care for the ones who exist. And certainly if the world were to become vegan, we would have a lot of people who would be interested in wanting to care for the ones who exist. I would say that individual animals have an interest in living, but that the DNA of the domesticated animals who've been bred in such a way as to suffer all sorts of really serious problems even before the farmer comes in and does things to them, like, for example, the laying of 300 eggs a year, and every farmed animal has something like that that really impairs their ability to enjoy the world, I would say that having fewer of those animals because we no longer breed them would mean that there could be many more wild species who could then flourish. We would no longer have a federal wildlife damage management, which is essentially a euphemism for killing wild animals who might compete with us for livestock. And we would not have to clear cut so many forests, and we could allow a lot of the greenery to return to their wild form, and that would be hospitable to a much more healthy environment for everyone and also for the proliferation of species who've been brought to threatened levels by our filling the world with billions and billions of animals who are not well adapted to live in it.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell University Law School and author of the book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger, and Other Questions People Ask Vegans. In your book, you speak about the challenges of becoming fully vegan. Would you elaborate on why it is not possible to be 100% vegan in our society?
The real reason is that because of the massive slaughter of animals, we have a lot of slaughterhouse byproducts that make their way into everything. Cheap byproducts, we see it everywhere. Roads, tires, plywood. It's really almost impossible to escape from these things. But also, I would say that there are methods of growing crops that involve using manure and so on. And these aren't necessary. It's not necessary to use these things. But because they're so cheap, because they're coming out of the slaughterhouse in such abundance, we use that. And therefore, it would be nearly impossible to conduct your life and eliminate all animal ingredients from it because they make their way into everything.
Could you give some examples of places animal products might be found that people might not be aware of?
Well, you know, tires, for example, that go on a car typically have animal ingredients in there. A lot of the adhesives used in, you know, building a home would involve slaughterhouse byproducts as well. So those are a few examples. So if you wanted to have a completely animal ingredient-free life, I think that would be very difficult to do. You know, if you eat plants, if you eat vegetables and fruit that come from most farms use manure in order to fertilize the crops. And again, it's a cheap way of fertilizing. It's not necessary. There are veganic farms that don't use that. But as long as there's this massive demand for slaughterhouse products, you're going to have these ingredients that are otherwise garbage, and so they're used for these various things.
Does the impossibility of becoming 100% vegan in our society make the effort futile?
Oh, not at all. Definitely not. I would say that, you know, the cliche is the perfect should not be the enemy of the good, and it's certainly possible to live vegan and largely vegan by deciding what we eat on the basis of it's not containing animal ingredients and what we wear. And with more and more vegans, fewer animals are slaughtered. And so the demand for vegan versions of these products that are currently impossible to get vegan create markets for it, like plywood and, you know, non-lethal methods of crop cultivation and so on. So I would say it is possible, particularly when it comes to food and clothing, to select food and clothing that is vegan, and that makes a huge difference.
Would you elaborate on the difference it makes for animals when an individual decides to become vegan?
The way in which, you know, a market economy works is that the reason animals are getting slaughtered is because people demand animal products. And so as soon as a person becomes vegan, that immediately reduces the demand for animal products, which in turn motivates less use of animals. And it's also true that because we're social species, when people become vegan, people around them then learn about it and say, oh, wow, you know, I've heard about that, but I don't know much about it. Can you tell me? And, you know, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because, you know, it helps to answer questions that people are increasingly having about this way of living that people weren't that familiar with. And so I myself, just from knowing people and people knowing me and knowing that I'm vegan and asking me about it, I know at least 20 people have become vegan just in the 7 years since I've been vegan. So everybody who becomes vegan, really, it has a multiplier effect as well. And that, again, reduces the demand for animal slaughter and animal harm and increases the demand for cruelty-free products.
What were some of your experiences in interacting with others when you first became vegan?
I had a very positive sort of transition into veganism, and people were curious and they were worried about protein. That was the big question. Where do you get your protein? And, you know, that wasn't a problem, and it wasn't a real stumper for me, because protein's just about every plant-based food you eat. And people were convinced it was very hard, so they would say, wow, you know, that must be so amazing that it's so hard to do. And it really isn't hard, and I could reassure them of that and, you know, make them meals. And people are generally quite respectful and accommodating, and most people are really open to it. I teach an animal rights seminar, and every week I bake some sort of, you know, vegan pastry, and people really enjoy that. And I think it helps to dispel the idea that, oh, vegan pastries are inferior. They're really not. And we see that more and more. The winner of whatever cupcake competitions ended up being a vegan, and she beat the people who were making non-vegan cupcakes. So you can make incredibly delicious food without any animal ingredients. So my experience really has been sort of as an educator, in a way, for even, you know, people who are friends and didn't know how simple and wonderful it is.
How do you handle the question, mind if I order the cheeseburger?
Good question. Well, a friend suggested a response that I often think is the best response, which is, do you really want to know? So if I'm eating dinner with somebody at a restaurant and they say, do you mind if I order the cheeseburger or the pizza or whatever it is? Then, you know, if I say, do you want to know? Do you really want to know? Then they have the opportunity to tell me, well, I don't actually want to know. Or they can say, well, yeah, I want to know. And then I'll say, yes, I do. Because I think people ask the question, it's a sort of question about tolerance, you know, are you going to tolerate me, are you going to tolerate the fact that I do this? And, you know, my response is, of course I'm going to tolerate, I mean, more than tolerate, I embrace people in my life, and not all of them are vegan, but I do believe that, it, you know, that the conduct is harmful and causes tremendous suffering and slaughter, so of course I mind. It's very different from different tastes, like, oh, do you mind if I order vanilla, even though you like chocolate, or, you know, an allergy, like, do you mind if I order bread, even though you don't eat gluten or something like that? I think it's a very, very different sort of thing, you know, and I explain that to people when they're interested.
In your book, you talk about the issue of vegans deciding how vegan they should be in different social situations. Would you comment on that?
Sure. Well, I think, like with any sort of movement that is small relative to the population at large, you have to decide, you know, how out am I going to be? And this is something that I've talked about and compared it to people who are gay and lesbian. And, you know, do you let people know that you're vegan? Do you go beyond that and explain to them why you're vegan? And I think it really very much depends for me on how receptive the people are who I'm with. And if I have a feeling that they're just really not interested and they don't want to know, then I'd probably say very little. They know I'm vegan. They know why, for the most part. And if they want to ask questions, they can. In other contexts, people are more curious and receptive and open, and then I can be much more forthcoming and talk to them about it and even point out to them, you know, wow, this thing that you've been complaining about, this heart condition that you have, and, of course, vegan ingredients don't contain cholesterol. So that can be a hugely helpful thing for people to know, and people can be very excited about it. I think it's a very exciting thing.
Why do you think people ask vegans so many questions?
I think it's a combination of things. I think people are curious, genuinely, sort of like, oh, and you're meeting somebody from this planet vegan that, you know, you hadn't encountered before. You want to know, what's your planet like? And I think also sometimes the questions come from defensiveness, that I think people in general, we tend to resist change, even when it's change for the better. And so we want to know, could I do this? You know, could I be vegan? And here are things I worry about. And so sometimes the questions come from there as well.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
My hope is that my book will open a dialogue between vegans and non-vegans about this really important subject and allow people to make an informed choice and act on values that are not just my values, but their values too. I think that the ethics that they already hold, they can act on it without fear or defensiveness, because it's really an entirely positive move. As I said, animals, environment, health, it really all signs point in the one direction. And I think that that's a rare thing, and it's really a wonderful thing.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would go back to one of your earlier questions about what it means to be vegan. And I've come to think of vegans as a group of people, and being vegan is really an important part of my identity now. But really fundamentally, being vegan is about what you do rather than who you are or what you believe. And vegans aren't this sort of insular tribe, but really a growing movement for nonviolence. And I wrote this book in part because being vegan means acting. It's something that I do and that people increasingly have begun to do because it reflects sort of nonviolent values and empathy and peace that I think most people embrace. And it's something that everybody can do to express this ethic of nonviolence toward animals. Most of us, I think, believe we should spare animals' lives when taking their lives is unnecessary, and veganism is the lived manifestation of that belief in action.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sherry.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell University Law School and author of the book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger and Other Questions People Ask Vegans, published in 2013 by Lantern Books. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.